Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Friday, and it's time for our Week in Review. Let's start with the busy news week for Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker. The latest is a new fundraising arrangement that has allowed the governor and the Mass GOP to raise millions of dollars and circumvent some of the state's limits on political contributions and on transparency. There were also some transparency questions raised when Baker left the state for a secret meeting of a neoconservative think tank last weekend. Baker told WGBH that he will let everyone know if he leaves the state in the future.
Anytime I travel outside Massachusetts, we'll make sure everybody knows that I've traveled outside Massachusetts. But I've gone outside Massachusetts a number of times where I didn't have any publicly scheduled events or I wasn't doing anything in my official capacity, where we didn't tell anybody because we didn't think we were supposed to.
We'll talk about this and other news with our Week in Review panel. Joining us in studio is Renee Loft, columnist for the Boston Globe and a writer for WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Also with us, Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Hi, Shira.
Hello.
Okay, so let's start with fundraising and Charlie Baker. The state cap for donations to political parties right now is about $5,000, but the Globe reported today that this group known as the Massachusetts Victory Committee, which is a joint effort between the state and national GOP, brought in almost $2 million last year, and the caps for that group, the donation caps, are $43,500. The Globe also said it's the only such committee in the country. Is there a problem with this type of political fundraising, and what does it say about Charlie Baker? Is it a problem for him, Renee?
Well, you know, I think Baker has hung his hat on the you know, technicality that this is all legal. It is indeed legal. But saying that this kind of fundraising is legal isn't really good enough for my mind. I mean, for one thing, laws can change. And indeed, Common Cause and other, you know, watchdog groups are trying to change these laws. But also, this is a fellow who likes to present himself as being in favor of transparency. And well beyond, really, the eye-popping numbers and amounts that he's been raising through this shadowy kind of committee is the, I think, even more concerning matter of its secrecy.
What does it say about Republicans in Massachusetts, I'm almost wondering? Is there a resurgence here? Can we draw any sort of message from that?
I think it makes it, you know, with all of this fundraising, it makes it more difficult for the Democrats to win next time around. But I think the important point and takeaway here really is the transparency point. And it also comes up again with the trip out of state that he didn't mention or didn't let people know about. You would think that politicians in Massachusetts would have learned their lesson with the Olympics and, you know, the lack of transparency there. Nothing goes right when you don't tell the whole story, or when you keep something from the public and you try to push something through, whether it's through fundraising or whether it's a trip out of state, and that can come back to bite you.
Well, let's talk about that trip that you referred to, Shira, because the governor did go to a neoconservative think tank trip.
The so-called World Forum.
Right, that's right, hosted by the American Enterprise Institute, and the issue was he didn't tell people. So Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido was essentially in charge and no one knew, and you heard that piece of tape that we used from the governor where he said, hey, I've left a number of times and I didn't say that I was leaving. I didn't have any formal notification. So I'm wondering, Renee, what do you think? Is there a problem here?
Well, you know, once again, he's hanging his, you know, reputation on what's strictly legal. I mean, yes, he's not required by the Massachusetts Constitution, you know, or by statute to tell the citizens of Massachusetts when he's leaving the state and when the lieutenant governor is in charge. But, you know, he's sort of know we had to, well, or we were supposed to.
But all of his predecessors did,
yes.
You know, disclose.
Yes. Mm. But, you know, I think this reflects some kind of ambivalence on the part of Charlie about his own role in national Republican politics. Because, you know, the sort of tendency to sort of hide these out-of-state forays to the National Governors Association or this think tank, you know, I think, you know, the governor has some problems with his own party on the national level and even to the, some extent in the state party. He's out of sync with the Republicans ideologically. He'd just as soon not remind the voters of Massachusetts that he is a Republican, frankly. Mm. And, you know, the last three Republican governors all heard the siren sound of Washington. And I think he's very conscious that the Massachusetts voters not see him as another, you know, somebody with his eyes on Washington, and that, you know, he cares only about Massachusetts. Every time he's asked to make an endorsement or what are you going to do in the presidential campaign, he says, oh, I'm focused on Massachusetts. And so you can sort of see, right, although I don't support it, why he would want to, you know, downplay his national ambitions.
Mm. Speaking of which,
I would say also, though, another reason why he might have wanted to downplay what was going on there was the panel that he was on. He participated on a forum about education, and he was on a panel with the, I said, you know, many will say the controversial political scientist Charles Murray. You may remember him as the person who wrote The Bell Curve, which was controversial because of tying, you know, the ties he put out forth between race and intelligence. I don't know if this is the type of publicity you want as a governor. And again, another reason for him to kind of go down there quietly unannounced.
Right. But also, just speaking of national issues, we all know about what happened during the presidential race, and he had endorsed Chris Christie and then didn't endorse anyone after Christie dropped out. But then this week, he also said something that was really divergent from the GOP in terms of he thinks that that Congress should hold confirmation hearings, the Senate should hold confirmation hearings on Merrick Garland, who is President Obama's choice for the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is obviously not in step with.
But good for him. Good for him for putting
good for Baker.
Good for Baker for putting himself out there and saying what makes the most common sense. I mean, this, if Republicans were smart, they would follow his lead, because otherwise you will have this very divisive party out there, and that, you know, they're crumbling, as many headlines have said this week. And you have a Republican politician who's viewed as a moderate saying what should be said, what the Republicans should be saying. So good for him for showing leadership in that, on that particular issue.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think this is probably Charlie Baker's true belief and true feeling. And, you know, he just...
And he shouldn't be afraid to voice it.
Precisely.
Okay. Let's move on a little bit, because aside from maybe some questions about transparency or what's going on and what's happening nationally, Charlie Baker did have a victory this week, and that was with opioid legislation for several months. So, you know, we had an opioid task force working on this. And we talked with him on our show on Radio Boston on Monday. Let's listen to what he had to say about the bill.
One of the things I admire most about this bill is it's pretty comprehensive. It's actually the fourth piece of legislation I've signed since we took office, which was only 14 months ago, to deal with this issue. But this was by far the most comprehensive, and in some respects has some elements in it that you're just not going to find anywhere else in the country. And I'm enormously proud to have been part of it.
It's, of course, Governor Charlie Baker talking about the opioid legislation that he signed into law this week. Is this a big victory for Governor Baker, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a very big victory for him, even though he had to compromise on some parts of the bill. For example, he wanted a three-day limit to prescription for, I believe it was acute pain, and instead they compromised to 7 days. Of course, that's better than what it was, which was a 30-day prescription.
Yeah, so on 3 days of involuntarily holding someone if they presented in an ER, and that didn't happen. Now it's a 24-hour evaluation.
Exactly. So there were a couple of issues on which he had to compromise, but still a victory, because I think the takeaway from this bill is it's changing the culture. Some other things that didn't get mentioned in the clip were the fact that you are going to dental students and medical students are going to be educated about the dangers of addiction and about prescribing opioids. So there's this cultural change, this shift in how we educate doctors, and also there's going to be more education for patients about the dangers of addiction. There's also going to be screening at the middle school and high school levels. So there are a lot of components about this that are moving Massachusetts, letting Massachusetts take a big step forward. It may not be perfect, but it's a big step forward when it comes to combating opioid addiction.
You agree?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it is a step forward. It's not a big enough step, considering that more people are now dying of drug overdoses in this state than by car accidents or guns. Mm. So at least the kind of attention that goes to those issues ought to go to opioid abuse. You know, there's the bill doesn't really take on the, you know, pharmaceutical companies that are promoting, you know, these drugs. It doesn't really fund fully treatment on demand, which people need. You need to be able to put somebody in a treatment bed the minute they decide they want to kick their addiction, not 3 weeks later when something opens up. So I think it's, you know, there's a lot that the bill does, and I'm proud of our state, and I'm proud of the governor for they had to do something, and they did. But, you know, I think there's more, there's far more to go.
And just listening to Baker's comments on this, it certainly seems like he's always ended, at least every interview I've heard him on the bill, he's always ended it by saying, you know, we're going to keep pushing here. We're going to keep looking for more opportunities to solve this problem or at least ameliorate the problem. And you mentioned the treatment aspect. I think that's such a big aspect because one of the big issues with opioid addiction is the constantly cycling through of patients. You know, the moment they get treated, they go back out and look for their next fix, and you have to sort of snap that cycle. There's only so much you can do culturally with educating doctors and pre-screening for middle school and high school students.
And, you know, it has to be both. And I think it's important to mention those cultural aspects, though, and those changes. It takes time. It took a long time with cigarettes. And, you know, I think that you know, I appreciate that those aspects are in the bill
as
well.
Yeah, and you always think about cigarettes, seatbelts, drunk driving, all sort of in the same area.
Okay, let's move on and make sure we get in some of the news about Newton North High School this week. There were more anti-Semitic graffiti signs found at Newton North, and of course this comes right after the brouhaha, after the Catholic Memorial game. That's Catholic Memorial, of course, an all-boys school in West Roxbury. They were squaring off in a basketball game against Newton North a week ago, and as the teams and their fans were chanting at each other, Newton North students shouted, "Where are your girls?" And Catholic Memorial fans and team members started shouting, "You killed Jesus." We did speak with some folks about this during the week. Here's Newton North senior Jonah Pemstein and his father, David Pemstein, who were at that game a week ago.
It started off pretty innocuously. We were chanting, "Here we go, Tigers," or something. And then it got a little more heated. And then eventually the "You killed Jesus" chant started.
We heard the "You Killed Jesus" chant, and I think there was a moment where everyone in our area just kind of paused in disbelief, and we kind of turned around and said, "Did they just say that?"
I think that was the question on everyone's mind after that. Are they really saying that?
It's unbelievable.
Am I hearing that? So Shira, what are your thoughts here? I mean, where does the accountability lie, and what needs to be done here?
Oh, gosh, where to start, honestly?
Right.
I mean, first of all, let's say this. Catholic Memorial took some admirable steps after this happened. They asked their students not to attend the basketball team's next game. They made the students who were at the Newton North game personally apologize to the principal of Newton North. They are going to hold a series of assemblies at the school about intolerance. And I think that's all well and good, and I think education is a very, very important component of this, because I'm not so sure that the students knew exactly what they were saying, how hurtful it was, the history behind that comment. So I think there has to be some education there. I also would like, though, there to be some, I guess, investigation into where did this come from? How are students picking up the idea that this is something nasty to chant at a basketball game? Where does this come from? Is it something that's being said in the home?
Well, it's pushing buttons, right?
It's pushing buttons, but where does it come from? Is there a teacher at the school? Is there something happening in homes where this misperception of history and this old Catholic thinking is coming out? And of course, we know that this is the "You Kill Jesus" thing is something that the Pope did away with. I believe we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of that. Mm-hmm. So I would like there not only to be education of the students, but also for them to there to be some research or investigation into how exactly it came to be that the students of Catholic Memorial thought that this was, came to chant this, thought this was something they should put out there.
Hmm. You know, I think this is broader than the incident at Newton North, which was, and the later racist graffiti, which is, you know, appalling. But the last time I was on this show, we were talking about racist incidents at Latin school.
Which, of course, mm-hmm. there are new ones there that we can talk about
right?
as well.
And, you know, this is not, as they say, an isolated incident. They're all over this country. There are examples of kids shouting, hurtful, racist things at ball games or in the hallways of schools. And you would think that given all of the sensitivity and all of the attention that this has gotten, especially in Boston, that kids and certainly their parents would have gotten the message by now. And yet I think there is a mixed message that this culture is sending out right now, which is the acceptability of crude, coarsened statements. You know, when the presidential candidates, not to name any,
that's right. Yeah.
But when presidential candidates are trash-talking each other with, right. Quite crude comments, it just becomes something that is endemic into the culture. And I don't know, I just feel that it's something like the opioid addiction issue. This needs to be addressed
but
culturally.
Really, would it seep down to young people this quickly?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I do. I mean,
they're all watching the news, watching the debates.
And they think it's okay to really push buttons and to really
to
go for the jugular.
To push buttons in this way. And, and I'll just give you an example from a Trump supporter that I saw. He was caught on video. He was, I guess, exiting a rally. And
we weren't mentioning any names. Sorry.
Oh, we weren't mentioning names. I'll mention names. I have no problem mentioning names. Trump supporter, again. And he was caught on video telling some of the protesters who were gathered there, protesters of Trump, why don't you go to Auschwitz?
Yeah.
And that was caught on video. So when you have that type of stuff, and you know how young kids are with their video and their YouTube and their Instagram and all of that and their social media, when you have that out there and that's an example and that's going viral, it certainly does seep down into the younger culture.
Governor Dukakis had a pungent old Greek saying that he was fond of, that he said sometimes, which was, the fish rots from the head.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I just think it's an example of our leaders have to be doing a better job of setting an example because the rot does travel down from the top.
Yeah. Also, the name of a recent scandal episode, The Fish Rots from the Head.
Oh, there you go.
So pop culture all the way around.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about sort of public pointed comments. They don't quite reach the level of what's happening on the presidential campaign trail. But, of course, there's a debate going on between casino mogul Wynn and Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone. Steve Wynn was in town this week, and he was talking about his $2 billion Wynn Boston Harbor project. And he is promising that this project will go forward, regardless of the recent environmental challenge that was filed by Mayor Curtatone. And here is Wynn speaking to reporters on Tuesday about one of Curtatone's concerns.
Air quality. You got to be kidding. We're mitigating the traffic. He's never lifted a finger to mitigate anything.
And then yesterday on Radio Boston, Mayor Curtatone was with us, and he responded saying that the 4,000 jobs promised by Wynn when compared to those generated by the Assembly Square project are not enough to justify the effects that this casino will have on the surrounding area. Let's listen.
I mean, it's laughable to even compare the two. It's apples and oranges. This is a better investment.
But it's not about which one's better, right?
No, but you asked me about 4,000 jobs. I laugh at that.
Because
it's laughable.
You think it should be
I should
be
give Wynn his own raspberry. 4,000 jobs.
That is Somerville Mayor Curtatone. Right? So is there a way to bring these two folks together, do you think? Or is this gambling issue? And Mayor Curtatone admits it. The issue is gambling. He doesn't like it. Can they ever get beyond that, really, to sort of reach a compromise where they won't be making raisins?
I don't know. My money's on Curtatone, I have to say.
He
is one tough mayor who I think really has, first of all, a vision for Somerville. And he has done a lot of great things and worked, to expand the city and expand the city's resources. He'll talk a lot about Assembly Row and what he's done there. And he's also a really tough guy who genuinely cares for his citizen and is trying to lift him up. I know, he's talking about traffic, and there's going to be some 20,000 cars coming through Somerville when the casino goes in. And I think there's also a feeling in Somerville that they're this constantly neglected city that everybody just drives through. I mean, I've had an opportunity to interview Mayor Curtatone, and we talked for a long while about the McGrath Highway and how it cuts off one entire segment of the city and how he wants to ground the highway. And I don't want to get too far afield here, but I think there is a constant feeling on Mayor Curtatone's part and on the part of Somerville that they're always on the way somewhere and they want to be the destination. They want people to care for Somerville. Curtatone does, wants people to care for Somerville the way he does. And he's going to fight, and he's going to fight hard. I don't see him giving up on this easily. And I don't think the Vegas charm of Wynn sways him one bit. I mean, he may charm some people in the local media. He may charm some locals. But I don't think that that holds much sway for him. And he's right. You know, Assembly Row, 20,000 jobs. Wynn Casino, 4,000 jobs. He has a good point there.
Mm-hmm. Spoken like a Somerville resident, perhaps.
But I'm not.
Oh, no.
No.
But maybe wish to be. You know, Somerville is really, you know, undergoing a renaissance. It's quite significant now. Right. And I do think that Curtatone, you know, is a rising star in, you know, local politics and, you know, very strong and very good on city planning for his city and a vision for Somerville. I think even he, though, admits that he's not going to stop this casino, that this ultimately this casino is, you know, unless there's some, you know, substantial collapse of the market, that this casino is on the road to being built. But he is going to slow it down long enough so that the, you know, truly damaging effects on his community can be mitigated. Maybe he's going to be going down a road similar to the one that Mayor Walsh went through where there's a settlement of the suit. It's a pretty good precedent that Walsh set. Or maybe, you know, maybe not. But I think that, you know, he has legitimate concern about the environmental impacts on his community. Ironically, I just want to say this little tidbit, there are also environmental groups that are pressuring Curtatone to back off his opposition right. to the casino because they see it as the last best chance to clean up the brownfield, the toxic brownfield.
The Monsanto that mess.
You know, casino would sit on. So, I mean, I think that's a role for government, not for Wynn, frankly. But,
and then if you throw into the mix the whole Green Line extension, which he wants to get through. I mean, there's, you know, it would be nice if Mayor Curtatone got something from Somerville, speaking as a non-Somerville resident, instead of, you know, just traffic. Yeah.
So let's make sure we have enough time here, briefly, for hubbubs. And those are our stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the news this week, but they've caught our attention. Renee, what's your hubbub for the week?
Well, this week, a new exhibit opened on the life and work of a world-famous architect, Moshe Safdie, who designed, you know, the Peabody Essex Museum, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, Marina Bay Sands, speaking of casinos, in Singapore, but who I think many people don't know is based out of a little office in Somerville.
There we go, back to Somerville. Exactly. All roads back to Somerville.
And, you know, this new exhibit, which is at the Boston Society of Architects space on Congress Street, is a career retrospective. It features all of his original drawings and models. They're quite beautiful, including one that he did for what was called Habitat 67, now I'm really dating myself, which was an innovative housing typology that he produced for the Montreal World's Fair in 1967 when he was still a graduate student.
Hmm. Shira, your hubbub.
I have to say, by the way, I'm a big fan of Moshe Safdie.
Okay.
I think he also did the Harvard Hillel building in Cambridge. I wanted to turn back to sports a little bit.
Okay.
It's been a banner week for women's sports. We started last Saturday with the Boston Pride winning the inaugural NWHL championship. And then in about, 30 minutes, the BC women's hockey team will take the ice in its quest for its first national championship. They are undefeated and ranked number one. And on Monday night, I had the pleasure of moderating a panel that was introduced by Attorney General Maura Healey about women, sports, and leadership. And it was sponsored by the Boston Renegades, the local women's football team. And I came away thinking that Boston is an incredibly impressive area. And city when it comes to women in sports and women doing things to advance athletics across, you know, all ages and all different events. And it was just a really incredible evening to be a part of and to see women from Boston putting themselves out there and leading the way.
Hmm. Not surprisingly, my hubbub is also a little bit about women as well. I was able to get these guys to pull a little music for me as well. So I'm going to give you a hint about what my hubbub's about. Okay, this is about Senator Elizabeth Warren and Star Wars. Yesterday, Senator Warren sent out a fundraising email titled, "I Won't Be Neutered." And that was in response to comments made by Missouri Congressman Blaine Lutgemeier. During an address to the American Bankers Association, Lutgemeier said that the banking industry needs to, quote, neuter Warren. In response, Warren's email asks, why would he go out of his way to say something so sexist and offensive? The congressman also, by the way, compared Senator Warren to a Star Wars character, calling her the, quote, Darth Vader of the financial services world. And Warren says, unfortunately, though, she's always seen herself as more of a Princess Leia type, a senator and resistance general who, unlike the guys, is never even remotely tempted by the dark side. Yay, right?
You were one of those waiting in line for the Star Wars movie, weren't you?
Really. All right, well, Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and writer for WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Thanks to you as well.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.